You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, you don't have to be an economist to know that the South African economy is flatlining. Every single indicator points to a crisis without peer in our history. Business confidence at the lowest levels since the survey began. Private sector economists predicting a plunge in GDP of 10% this year. The SARB's leading business indicator and its longest downturn since the Second World War. And results yesterday of a business survey that have never been released before. The University of Stellenbosch Bureau of Economic Research's other services survey of sectors that account for about a fifth of the economy showed confidence in the second quarter plunging to the lowest level in the survey's 15-year history. It also showed an unmatched drop-off in activity. The survey covers industries such as real estate, restaurants, hotels, transport and business services, all of those really impacted by COVID-19. And the Reserve Bank's coincident indicator for April, which gives a view of current economic activity, slumped 22% from the prior month and 26.8% from a year earlier. These were the largest collapses in data going back to 1960. And so far, what have we seen in response? Well, we've seen real rates cut by 0.35% when declining CPI is taken into account, last at just over 2%, and a 500 billion rand pop gun, which when one strips away the failed 200 billion rand loan guarantee scheme, has proved to be shooting blanks, and government relief schemes, which have largely missed the mark too. So lots for the Reserve Bank to consider as it begins its two-day meeting today. Let's welcome our guests to consider what the Reserve Bank could and should be doing at this time of crisis. Old Mutual Chief Investment Strategist Dave Muir, Professor Brian Cantor, an economist and former Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment, and also Professor Emeritus at the University of Cape Town, where he was the Dean of the Faculty of Commerce and Head of the School of Economics, Peter Retard Montalto, Head of Capital Markets Research at Intellidex, and Duma Gubule, who is Founding Director at the Center for Economic Development and Transformation. Brian, kick us off. This economy desperately requires extraordinary measures, and you've been calling for the Reserve Bank to follow the developed market playbook when it comes to QE. In the past, I think most mainstream economists would have balked at the idea. Can you just explain why this unconventional policy is required now?
Well, South Africa's economic activity is deeply depressed and will remain so. In fact, I got a bigger number, that coincident indicator, which is a good measure of GDP. It's a monthly measure for April, 77.3. So down perhaps nearly 30% on a year ago. So we've got an economy in crisis, and that's not news. It's just a question of how deep is the recession. And the way you deal with the recession is you try and encourage spending as much as you can, and you try and offer relief as much as you can to people who've been badly hurt. And the Reserve Bank has a crucial role to play in providing such stimulus. And lowering interest rates is part of that, but it's not the only part of that. You can lower interest rates and we had room to lower interest rates given the fact that our interest rates were significantly higher than in the developed world, and you can create money. And creating money helps to stimulate bank lending and helps to encourage spending. So money creation at a time like this is part of the playbook. And I think other emerging market economies, Chile, Brazil, Indonesia, I think have been much more direct and proactive and willing to accept that kind of responsibility to do what you can to stimulate spending. And that loan guarantee scheme is a big part of it. Now, I think that is a promising line. The Treasury has covered the losses on such loans, but we are not seeing those loans being delivered. And one really wants to know why not? What's holding it back? Because surely business needs financial support, needs working capital to get back on its feet. And if they don't get back on its feet, they won't provide the jobs. And if you don't provide the jobs, you won't get any extra spending. So it seems to me that monetary policy at a time like this is much more than just about inflation. In fact, to talk inflation at a time like this, to use a well-worked metaphor, is like shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. You really got to do more than that.
Peter Todd-Montalto, what do you make of the call for massive doses of extra government spending and money creation at a time like this?
Well, I think there is a view somehow that you can magically find efficient places to put this, that the government is an efficient machine to be able to deploy this money. And theoretically, that might well be the case in some idealized economy, but not with this current state machinery, the inability to implement, the inability to, you know, push infrastructure spending forward, for instance, not because, you know, there aren't workers ready to work in construction, but because the energy policy, the water policy, the PPP policy isn't there. And I think when the Saab talks about structural reform, they are talking, you know, about those mechanics that can actually allow money to flow through the economy. But I think the fiscal multiplier debate, which has come up, which, remember, the Saab has now engaged in with the a number of different op-eds and contributions and working papers from staff as well since the last MPC meeting, is a big challenging debate that has to be had in South Africa. I think, you know, it's all well and good to say that there's nothing better to do with the money than the state to spend it during the peak of a crisis. But this money then gets trapped in government bonds that banks and others could otherwise be spending on credit creation through a recovery process. And that's really the challenge. We've now seen a big, big step up of about an increase of about 5 percentage points in terms of the share of holdings from banks in government bonds. And that's ultimately what crowds out investment through a recovery. And I think that's the challenge that the Saab is highlighting on this debate.
Dave, what do you see as the inherent risks and trade-offs here? Because on the one hand, you've got those who are opposed to QE saying that despite it being a temporary policy measure, the risks are there for it to become permanent and a permanent feature and lead to an inflationary spiral a la Venezuela and Zimbabwe. On the other hand, you're hearing the arguments from Professor Brian Cantor and others that it's necessary now to help stimulate an economy that is absolutely flatlining as a temporary measure. How do you see the debate?
If you look at the debate, I fully agree with Brian. I think under these circumstances, you should focus on broader financial stability. And this is the one thing about locking down an economy. It's an enormous threat to the financial stability of an economy. And, you know, so in terms of looking at that, the Reserve Bank, I mean, they've changed capital reserve requirements for banks, etc. I think those things are moving in the right direction. As a step, the loan scheme is moving in the right direction. So I think we need more of that, less of a focus on whether the short-term interest rate is, you know, 4.75% or 2.75%. I don't think that would make a major difference. I think over the last 10 years, and certainly this is the lesson we've learned with the crisis in 2008 and 2009, that central banks have to use more levers than just interest rates. So I'm firmly in the camp that says that we need to be more creative. We've got to think out of the box. It's a very different set of circumstances from normal economic policies. Yes, we need to look at structural adjustment programs and all of that. But also need to keep in mind that those things in the short run tend to contract economic activity as you shift resources around, as you move people from state-owned organizations into the private sector, hopefully. And against that background, I think you've got to keep the monetary wheels running. You've got to keep the engine oiled well. So I'm in the camp where I think we certainly need quantitative easing. People are always worried about Venezuela and Zimbabwe. I don't think, you know, we're talking about monetizing 100% of the budget deficit we have when your economy has collapsed and you're not collecting taxes. I think the Financial Times, which is typically quite a conservative newspaper, said that if you look at countries like South Africa that are fragile under these risky circumstances, you know, we can consider quantitative easing programs running up to 5% of GDP, which is roughly 250 billion rand. So I do think we need to look at those things under these circumstances. These are extraordinary circumstances. It's not something that we should be thinking about doing permanently. I think these are measures that are called for in these times.
Duma, the Reserve Bank governor has over the last few months been at pains, as was mentioned already in various op-eds by Peter Attard-Montalto and other members of the bank, saying that QE, or the purchase of government and corporate bonds, will cause runaway inflation. It'll cause interest rates to go close to zero. What do you make of some of those technical arguments against QE now?
Well, Michael, we're heading towards a deflationary danger zone. We've got inflation at 2%. And I think there's no, in every interview I've heard him, he says there is no inflationary threat currently. So I think that there is no excuse now that the bank has to reflate the economy. And I do think that we should be talking about, I've been talking about a public-private agency that will allocate the funds that we raise. You would have this agency, like, let's just say a repurposed solidarity fund. It could be in all provinces, and the public sector, municipalities, private sector, community organizations, they could bid for projects that they want to do to set up jobs. I just remember in Gauteng, in Johannesburg, where I am, the former mayor used to talk about 170 billion rand infrastructure backlog. So he would go to that public-private agency and say, I want to do this, I want to do this. And then the agency would award these contracts on the basis of certain criteria that they agree up front. And I understand that in the US, after the New Deal, they set up many of these agencies. I think there are about more than a dozen of these agencies. So we should look at creating, I do agree that we have to find a way of bypassing government in terms of the distribution of these stimulus funds.
And that is back to Brian, your point is that what this will effectively do is allow banks to play a greater role in the economy, and that's really what we're talking about here through a program like this, not necessarily using the state as the chief allocator of capital here, if I understand you correctly.
Well, I think there's urgency required here, and one of the disappointments, I suppose, if it was a disappointment, that the government really had no obvious plan. Now, the way to accelerate relief for businesses who, after all, have been shut down, seeing cash bleed away, they help businesses immediately is through their normal source of finance, which is the banks. So that's an immediate way of responding to an immediate crisis. Remember the economy, as it gets back to work, the firms that supply work and goods and services will need some encouragement. They need some demand to justify increasing output and increasing employment. And I think there's a further point. I agree. This talk about infrastructure, yes, those are long-term considerations. What you need now is income relief and relief for business. I think the banks can play the part. I really do think we need to question why aren't they doing more lending. At the last count, there was 10 billion or so committed to that scheme. There's a potential 200 billion, that is 4% of GDP. That's meaningful, but you've got to really change the conditions under which banks provide credit, and the Treasury stands behind them if they make if people default on the loan. So that's an immediate requirement, and I think something you could do immediately, or you think you should be able to do that. Banks should be lending, and the Reserve Bank should be supporting them with cash. So Reserve Banks create money not only by buying bonds in the market, they create money by lending to banks. Now, in March, they lent a lot more to the banks. It was up to over 100 billion of accommodation to the banking system. That's now down to 66 or so billion. So one doesn't see any impetus in the Reserve Bank's balance sheet to do more for the banks.
Mm-hmm. Peter, the risk is here that the SARB perhaps pushes it too far and, to Dave's earlier point, monetizes its debt and then investors flee. How real is that risk? George Glenos put that to S&P the other day. I certainly can't see this kind of short-term quantitative easing leading to full-blown monetization of the entire budgetary debt.
So, I mean, these are two separate things, ultimately. I mean, I think the monetization of debt and the basically buying of bonds in the primary market is something that certainly isn't going to happen under this current leadership, and there's definitely been a very strong red line put in place. But I think the problem of the quantitative easing debate is that it's been sort of had in sort of abstraction without thinking about actually what this money is meant to be spent on, the efficacy of doing that, the policy changes are required to actually allow the productive spending of this kind of money. And that's ultimately, I think, what the Saab is concerned with. And I think and that's why in the long term, it is possible that they could do quantitative easing. I think if you, for instance, found South Africa in an IMF standby arrangement where there were enforced structural reforms, I think it could be possible the Saab could do sort of real QE in the long term. But in the interim, I think the problem of the debate, again, that the Saab doesn't quite want to have, is that the reasons behind this are also quite deeply political, about the slippery slope that you create, the fact that, I think Tito Mboweni isn't going to be there forever as minister. We could well see attacks on the Saab and its independence coming back for whack in the medium run, because, as Brian said earlier, growth and the recovery is going to be so slow, those attacks, I think, are going to intensify in the medium run. And so there is a deeper strategic, I think, sense behind this, but that's not what the Saab wants to say, which I think then creates somewhat of a more sort of convoluted debate in the forefront. But for now, they've stated their policy aim is to narrow bid offer spreads in the secondary bond market. They've been successful in that. It's currently at around 4.3 basis points. The wides were at 14 basis points in the end of March. And so for now, they seem quite happy with where they're at.
Dave, do you think that this bond buying program, and just to maybe broaden the conversation, we know the South African government is in discussions with the IMF. Do you think it will make it tougher to obtain IMF funding?
I think necessarily so, because, I mean, if we look at the trend that we've seen internationally, and our central bank has behaved relative to other central banks, I think we fall into the camp of being certainly on the most conservative side of central banking in the world. As I say, I'm not talking about full-scale opening up, monetizing the whole deficit, but I do think that, this will be tolerated. I know South Africa, your big problem is credibility. I think that's what the Reserve Bank is guarding against, and one cannot blame them for that. But again, I want to come back to my point that these are exceptional circumstances. If we look at our budget deficit, that horrific number of 700 billion plus that we've mentioned, if we don't have some primary funding of that by the central bank, or we don't get a massive IMF loan or something like that, what's the alternative? How are we going to fund that? The planned cutback in spending that was announced, I think, is socially untenable at this point, certainly against the background of an extremely weak economy. So this must not be a one-sided debate. One must look at the alternatives. But again, I want to emphasize this is something for current circumstances, not an ongoing panacea for all our economic problems that are generated by a vast array of other forces in this economy.
Absolutely. And as we see this vast array of economic plans at the moment trying to identify where those problems are, and find some kind of convergence, the Business for South Africa plan, the Tito plan, the ANC plan, and bless you, Peter Retard-Montalto, for even reading the South African Communist Party's plan. We are not for a shortage and surfeit of plans at the moment. I think we do identify that the common weakness is incapacity, Duma, in actually being able to implement, and you mentioned earlier, bypassing the state to some extent. What else could the Reserve Bank be doing in an environment where it's saying no to quantitative easing? What are the other levers, if any?
Well, there's a whole spectrum of places where the Reserve Bank can get involved. I would like to see this being expanded to the Development Bank of South Africa, to the IDC. Both institutions have been untainted by allegations, or relatively untainted by allegations of state capture. And the way it's going right now, there's a crisis going to happen. We've got a crisis in terms of our state-owned enterprises. I do think we need to monetize at least half of the Eskom debt. they're falling like dominoes, all the state-owned enterprises. So the central bank has to get involved in some of that as well. And I do believe that we're going to see a bigger crisis in terms of the municipalities and the big metros, where I saw that their revenue in some cases by about up to 60%. So this crisis in terms of the municipalities and so forth, the central bank will have to backstop sort of a lot of institutions throughout society. And I would like to see a... So what I'm saying is that I agree that some of it has to be income support, much more income support than you'd have under normal circumstances. And income support has lower multipliers, especially in this kind of situation. But we have no other option but to provide more income support for households, for firms, and so forth.
Peter, you're shaking your head there at the thought of monetizing Eskom's debt. What do you make of that suggestion?
Well, I think this is basically, you know, a complete recipe for poor incentives for government. I mean, the idea of supporting DBSA is basically saying that you're willing to backstop SAA through the central bank. And that's ultimately what this comes down to. And the conception of the DBSA in the future that the ANC has is basically that the DBSA should be undertaking the sort of pet projects, the rent extraction, the corrupt projects that the private sector is unwilling to bank. And therefore, the staff should have be giving a free lunch to the DBSA. So I think that argument is sort of, complete madness, actually. And the real problem we have are these sort of perverse incentives. There's plenty of money, theoretically, in the budget if we were to cut out SOE funding, for instance, and SOE bailouts, for there to be even a basic income grant, actually. If there were to be restraint on the public sector wage bill for the last decade, there would be plenty of room for a basic income grant. And I think this is the problem in having this debate, and the SARB isn't fully able to say this, but you need a pain and a pressure point, ultimately, for poor decisions of the last decade or more really to come back to bite.
Brian, just as we conclude here, the issue, I think, to sum up Peter Taubman-Tolto, is one of moral hazard. How do we ensure that these decisions don't create that moral hazard that leads to poor decision-making and backstops for profligacy and corruption and all the rest of it?
Yes, well, that is the problem. I mean, we've got the issues that complicate our reaction to this crisis, these wider, bigger issues. And of course, the Reserve Bank, I think, in some ways hides behind the fact that it defends against some of the madness as was described. But that doesn't absolve it from making the right judgments for now in a confident, considered way, and recognizing that these are temporary measures. And without these temporary measures, the revenue will collapse even further. And Dave made the point. I mean, how are you going to fund this growing deficit for now? And I agree. You can't fund it at the long-term end of the market because the spread between long and short rates in South Africa has never been wider. So the government's got to pay an extra 6% to borrow long over borrowing short. And we hope that borrowing short will become cheaper still. So it's got to be able to borrow short and issue much more short-term debt, treasury bills, to the banking system that will be supported by the central bank, acting to help debt management. It has to happen. And incidentally, the government has a large deposit with the Reserve Bank, some $200 billion. It's drawing down that deposit. That is money creation as well. That's also a form, if you like, of money creation, where you draw down your deposit, around $200 billion. You fund current spending. If that spending is in South Africa, that adds to the money base. But you need to be able to separate these issues, and you need to be able to say, this is what we're doing in a crisis. It will help, but we will be able to address the long term issues in a capable way, and that means controlling government spending, but not for now.
Absolutely.
That makes no good sense.
Well, I think lots for the Reserve Bank MPC to consider as it sits down and has its meeting, the announcement tomorrow, about a whole lot more than just interest rates at the moment. Professor Brian Cantor, economist and former chief investment strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment, Old Mutual chief investment strategist Dave Moore, Peter Atard-Montalto, head of capital markets research at Intellidex, as always looking resplendent in that fine mustache of his, and Duma Gubule, founding director at the Center for Economic Development and Transformation.